I'm very grateful to talk about my book, Adventure Capitalism, A History of Libertarian Exit from the Era of Decolonization to the Digital Age. This is a book that came out in 2022. And of course, there's been a lot of stuff coming out now about libertarians and tech bros and things like this. And this was a kind of effort on my part to address this sort of early on. I was working on this in 2017 and 18 and up into the pandemic. So I'll just say a little bit about the book. Basically, this is a book that is a history of wealthy people, fairly wealthy people, who wanted to, in some form or another, leave their own societies, let's say the United States or the United Kingdom, sometimes Australia, but mostly sort of Anglophone developed countries. And they wanted to leave and they wanted to not become expatriates. What they wanted to do was leave and find a place where they could set up their own countries. In most cases, the projects I look at are people attempting to set up their own countries that would be run akin to a corporation. These would be private states. These would be contract states in which to live there, you would invest money and sign a contract in which you would pay for the services that would be provided to you. If you chose not to pay for them, they would not be provided to you. Basically, the idea was a very ultra-minimalist state. I refer to this as libertarian exit. The reason I use that terminology, first of all, is the vast majority of people that were involved in this, certainly in the 1960s and 1970s, but I think also it's fair to say today as well, defined themselves in some form as libertarians. And what I mean by this is they are not anarchists. These are not people who are anti-government and anti-capitalist. They are classic U.S., UK-style libertarians, which means they are anti-government or small state, let's say, radically small state, and hyper-capitalist. They're radical individualists. These are people who define freedom essentially as private property rights, and they ideally see the state, the federal government, as something that should be stripped down to its absolute bare minimum. And what that means is the institutions necessary to protect private property rights, individual private property rights, the institutions necessary to protect you from direct violence, from fraud, from breach of contract. So essentially, national defense, policing, and a very small judiciary to deal with questions such as patent violation, fraud, breach of contract, and so forth. These were individuals both in the 1960s and 1970s and to this day inspired by a small group of people who sit on a kind of spectrum of what you might call libertarianism. Some of them, in fact, rejected that term, but I think it's fair to put them sort of in a large umbrella. These would include the Russian emigre novelist, wannabe philosopher Ayn Rand. Atlas Shrugged is perhaps her most famous book that tech titans in Silicon Valley are very eager to give out to their employees. Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich von Hayek, two European economists from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, who were very prominent in attempting to make a kind of philosophical and economic argument for the sovereignty of the market over the sovereignty of the state. And you could also include here someone like Milton Friedman, who famous University of Chicago economist who was deeply involved in the transformations of the Chilean economy in the wake of the coup d'etat of 1973 that brought Augusto Pinochet to power and basically implemented a kind of what Naomi Klein has called shock therapy in Chile. Exit is not expatriation. These are not people just heading off to go hang out in prominent hotel bars and listen to old classics and drink cocktails. What they want to do is they want to leave and create a new sovereign entity, and they want to create it along libertarian lines, as I mentioned, basically transactional, contractual, private, driven by market relations. The problem they always confronted, of course, then and now, is the fact that the planet is essentially divided up into parcels of existing sovereignty. So the question always for them has been and continues to be where to do this. So this is a history. I'm a historian. I'm a historian of Latin America. I got involved in this because of some interest around colonization on the open ocean, or efforts to colonize the open ocean, which I'll talk about in a minute. So I look at the kind of historical trajectory of projects like this. It's obvious that all of this stuff is around us all over the place now. We've got Jeff Bezos with his space rocket. We've got Elon Musk attempting to suggest that we can actually colonize and terraform Mars. We have a lot of ideas about uploading one's consciousness into a computer mainframe, and so on and so forth. The point I wanted to make in part with the book is that these are distractions. They're vanity projects. They're silly. No one's going to be colonizing Mars anytime soon in our lifetime or our grandchildren's lifetime, to be perfectly frank. These are essentially sort of grifts, speculative venture capitalist kind of projects. They bring in some money, they bring in a lot of attention, but they're really distractions. There is a space race happening, but it's not in outer space. It's here on our planet. And we need to pay attention to those projects. They're a little more mundane. Some of them are still quite spectacular, but in general, they're a little more mundane, and they're more analog than they are digital, if we wanted to use that kind of terminology. Some of the contemporary projects that I talk about in the book are seasteading. Seasteading is the idea that you can, on the high seas or the open ocean, where supposedly there are opportunities to create some kind of private country like this, it's not entirely clear that's the case, but seasteading is the idea that you can build these floating platforms on the high seas where people can exit to and create their own kind of mini communities and societies that would be floating and that could migrate to one another depending on people's shared mutual interests. This really started in 2008 with the founding of the Seasteading Institute. This was founded with a $500,000 angel investment from Peter Thiel, very famous Silicon Valley iconoclast, Trump supporter, head of Palantir, amongst other things. And it was first directed by Patrick Friedman, who's the grandson of free market fundamentalist Milton Friedman and son of anarcho-capitalist David Friedman. That's one example. These are ongoing, these efforts. I can talk a little bit more about them later. They haven't really gone anywhere. They've realized that as much as they like to talk about piracy and rogue waves and things like this and sort of yuck it up, but the real problem they confront is labor costs. And so they've had to constantly move closer and closer to shore with their projects. And even those are not particularly going anywhere fast. The other contemporary project I think people should really pay attention to, and this is ongoing, is what are known as free private cities. It started off as an idea known as charter cities, also around 2008. You're noticing here a theme, the economic crisis of 2008 and the opportunities it provided for people who have enormous amounts of wealth. Free private cities and charter cities, the basic idea here is to negotiate with governments and places around the world that have an array of kinds of development issues, foreign aid issues, and things like this, and to negotiate with them for them to cede a portion of their sovereign territory to a kind of group of international investors and an international oversight board where a brand new city can be created. And this would be a kind of opt-in, opt-out city. The initial idea of charter cities was that it would be something akin to a nostalgic vision of Hong Kong or maybe Singapore. The idea would be that you could opt in or opt out. You wouldn't have voting rights. You could either sign the contract and choose to live there or not sign the contract and not live there. But there wouldn't be voting rights or any kind of democratic processes and so forth. That project, Charter Cities, began in Madagascar in 2008. A coup overthrew the government in Madagascar and it brought the Charter City project to an end. And then a coup in Honduras opened up the possibility for it. It subsequently has morphed in Honduras into something quite distinct from what it began as. Now, free private cities are gated. They're gated communities. They really are places for people to, you know, sort of digital nomads and others to invest their money. There are places to kind of experiment with forms of governance. They've tried to structure their own arbitration boards. In Honduras, they actually are radically immune from most of the articles in the Honduran Constitution and the like. And so These are ongoing. There's actually one called Roatan Prospera on the island of Roatan off the coast of Honduras that I encourage your listeners to take a look at. So these are two of the kind of mundane projects that I look at that are happening currently. But the other thing I wanted to do in this book was to not pretend as if, or to not drink the Kool-Aid that the Silicon Valley tech crowd, a lot of whom are really pushing a lot of these projects, want us to drink, which suggests that they invented all of this stuff, that it's kind of sui generis, it's emerged fully formed out of their own brains. There's a long, long history to these kinds of projects. And I wanted to really dig into that history so as not to somehow or another give credit where it's not due, which is to the contemporary Silicon Valley crowd. So I go back and you could go back very far. We could go back to a whole array of different kinds of projects like this, going back to, think about More's Utopia, Francis Bacon's New Atlantis in the literary world. But you can also think about the variety of things that came under the charge of the East India Company, right? The company state. You could think about the array of projects in the 19th century, people trying to find little outposts, the man who would be king in Afghanistan, and so on and so forth. There's many of these, which I mention in passing in the book. But I basically go back to the 1960s, another era of economic crisis, another era of technological innovation, another era of concerns about ecology, demographic collapse, all these kinds of things. It's actually an era that is quite resonant with our own. It is also an era in which not only do you have the rise of the so-called new left in a place like the United States, but also, of course, a different kind of left emerging in many places around the world in the midst of decolonial politics and anti-colonial politics, France, Mexico, and elsewhere. It's also an era in which you see a kind of emergence of a very serious libertarian movement as well. As much as it's the age of Aquarius, it's also the age of Atlantis. And Atlantis is the sort of touchstone symbol for libertarians over the years. So I go back to the 1960s and the 1970s, and I look at the projects of a man by the name of Michael Oliver and the people around him. So not just Michael Oliver, who's a very interesting individual and someone who, in fact, I can understand a little bit about why he might want to flee the places that he's living, because he had been a victim in the Holocaust. He was from Lithuania. All his family was persecuted and killed. He survived two different concentration camps, two different Nazi concentration camps before coming to the United States at the age of 18. So you can understand a little bit that, of course, Michael Oliver is going to be very attentive to what's happening in the world around him, and he feared what was unraveling in the United States in the 1960s, and he began to look for places to set up a new country. He had a lot of backers, a lot of supporters who were very involved in the projects with him. Harry Schultz, who was had a very famous international newsletter and was a kind of investment specialist, very, very prominent in the 1960s and the 1970s, he had support from, the Koch brothers were involved in some of these projects tangentially. Folks involved with Reason magazine, which is the most important libertarian magazine of the last part of the 20th century in the United States. There were oil and wheat magnates, a lot of backing of various kinds. And they set out collectively to see if they could, in fact, take advantage of processes of decolonization and find ways to and places to set up their own private states. And I take you through in the book, I take readers through three projects that are quite prominent and quite important. These are, in many ways, these are seen as fringe projects. They failed. None of these came to fruition. But I think they are actually quite revealing of how these projects unfold and what it is people are attempting to do. And they're also quite revealing of these ongoing efforts to engage in new forms of colonization and dispossession. Part of the reason I did this project also is because a lot of the writing, both back in 2015, 16, and 17, and today, really pays attention to the promoters and schemers of these projects. But it pays very little attention to what is happening in the places where these people go to try to set up their projects. So I'm very attentive, for example, in my chapter on free private cities, I'm very attentive to what's happening in Honduras on the ground. Resistance to these projects, people who are collaborating with these projects, and so forth. the same with seasteading. And then with the projects that I look at from the 60s and 70s, I really want to know what's happening in the places where these characters go. There's three projects. I'll mention them very quickly. Each one of these projects has an entire chapter in the book dedicated to it. The first is the Minerva Reef. The Minerva Reef, this was a project in 1971 and 1972 into 1973. This is two atolls in the Southwest Pacific. So if you know where Fiji and Tonga are, you would look south, a little bit southwest of Tonga, in between Tonga and New Zealand, and you would find these two little atolls called the Minerva Reefs, and they are essentially underwater about 23 hours out of the day. Here was a place where, at least in theory, Oliver and his backers thought that they could, in fact, lay claim to one of these atolls. And they hired a dredging vessel. They took the dredging vessel there and they dredged sand, piled it on the reef so that the reef would be above water 24 hours a day. And the idea was then to build a series of platforms and to build a small city-state that would eventually expand to house up to 30,000 residents. And this was the Republic of Minerva project. It's quite well known in the sort of world of people who are interested in these kinds of things. Coins were minted that are very valuable that you can look for on eBay if you're so interested. They did a lot of the kind of work of state making that many people do when they think about the symbolic trappings of statehood. They minted coins, they created a flag, all this kind of stuff. Not an anthem, as far as I can tell, but a lot of other that kind of stuff. The problem, of course, for them was that the ocean is not just out there for colonization, including atolls, even if they sit outside the political zone controlled by archipelagos in the Southwest Pacific. So the King of Tonga got wind of what was happening. He assembled a small army, and they went to the reef, to Minerva Reef, and they took down the first kind of physical manifestations of the Republic of Minerva and laid claim to both reefs. And in this, at the time, they had the backing of other Southwest island nations, including Fiji, Nauru, and others. And the reason is very simple, which is that all of these nations understood that if this was not cut off at the knees immediately, then there would be a kind of atoll or reef rush by people with money trying to set up similar kinds of private states on atolls and seamounts in the Southwest Pacific. From there, the group of people that I'm looking at, these kind of libertarian adventurists, decided that it might be easier to set up a private state in an existing place that is decolonizing rather than to try to create one from scratch on the high seas or on an atoll. And so Oliver got wind of a movement in the northern part of the Bahamas. So the Bahamas was slated for independence in 1973. The British were eager to pass off independence to the Bahamas, and the government was going to be run clearly by Prime Minister Pindling, Black, which is important because the northern islands, the Abaco Islands of the Bahamas, had a fairly large white population. They bristled at the idea of both independence and being led by a Black government based in Nassau. And they, first of all, lobbied to stay as part of the UK, the United Kingdom. This was denied, this request was denied. And they then began to imagine the possibility of secession. And in the process of doing this, they linked up with a variety of people, including someone I've already mentioned, Harry Schultz, this investment specialist with a very prominent newsletter. They hooked up eventually with Michael Oliver, and they hooked up with a former OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA, an OSS operative and weapons specialist by the name of Mitchell Livingston Werble III. Werble is quite a fascinating character. He created silencers for some of the deadliest weaponry in the 20th century, including the Ingram Mach-10, which was a very famous weapon. If you've watched any kind of 70s political thrillers, the Ingram Mach-10 shows up. 3 Days of the Condor, John Wayne as McHugh, Killer Elite with James Caan. We could go on and on. The Wire, the Ingram Mach-10 shows up in The Wire. A very deadly submachine gun. And so Werble was a pretty interesting character, and he got involved in this in part because he wanted to have the possibility of creating a manufacturing site on the Bahamas. So in this instance, they began funding and supporting this secessionist movement. It fizzled out, and it fizzled out for a number of reasons. There was strong pushback from the central government in the Bahamas. There was also FBI investigations as to whether or not the schemers and the plotters were in fact breaking U.S. law by interfering with the democratic processes of another country. And they fizzled out because Werbel himself was drawn into an investigation over the importation of massive quantities of marijuana into the United States and was brought before a congressional subcommittee. The last project was a similar kind of project in terms of fomenting secession, but this one had a longer lifespan and it had more troubling consequences. And this was in the archipelago of the New Hebrides in the Southwest Pacific. Here, again, Oliver, also John Hospers. John Hospers was a philosophy professor at the University of Southern California and one of the first individuals to run for president of the United States on the Libertarian ticket. Also described by one U.S. official as a fringe member of an Ayn Rand school, which I always found quite interesting. The project here was they hooked up with a chief in the northern part of the New Hebrides named Jimmy Stevens. The New Hebrides is an archipelago of about 80 islands. It was colonized jointly by the French and the British in the early 20th century. The northern portion of the islands, if we're talking beyond native dialects, are largely Francophone, and the central and southern portion of the islands are largely Anglophone. Jimmy Stevens was a chief on the island of Santo in the northern part of the archipelago. He had big political aspirations in some ways, and at the same time, he was also keenly interested in protecting the rights of Santo Bush people on the island. Santo is the largest island in the archipelago and one of the most economically important. He was losing ground to another anti-colonial movement in the archipelago that was Anglophone rather than Francophone. And so he was looking for ways to bolster his power and his standing. And so, interestingly enough, you have an anti-colonial organizer, Jimmy Stevens, essentially allying himself with a group of U.S. libertarians with the idea that they would provide him backing so that he could declare the secession of the northern portion of the archipelago. In exchange, they would get rights to land where they could, in fact, set up a kind of private city-state of the kind that they had been trying to create in the Republic of Minerva and then subsequently in Abaco in the Bahamas. This was a very conflictual and convoluted process from 1975 to 1980. I go into pretty significant detail in the chapter about what unfolds here for a number of different reasons that I lay out for readers. But it ends with a rebellion in 1980, the Santo Rebellion, in which Jimmy Stevens has a son who is killed. You have a couple of thousand native people of Vanuatu who are displaced. There is violence within communities. Stevens and his collaborators are sentenced to prison. One of his collaborators acquires tetanus in prison and dies almost immediately. So it's a tragic story in that respect. And of course, the libertarian Exeters who helped foment this secessionist movement went back to their homes in Southern California and in Carson City, Nevada. So that's the trajectory of the book, and that's what I've tried to do in the book, is to give a very detailed and kind of granular history of how these projects unfolded in the 60s and 70s and what generated and pushed and promoted them, and then the way they've come back to us now in our contemporary moment. The last thing I'll note here, just in terms of giving you a sense of the book, is the ways in which the projects in the 60s and 70s were not just about sort of tax evasion, tax avoidance, things like this. People have plenty of money to hire lawyers and to do all that kind of stuff. These are really sort of ideological projects. Whether or not they were actually really ever going to sort of exit the state is highly unlikely. They weren't going to give up their U.S. citizenship or their U.K. citizenship at any point in time. But it was a kind of ideological experiment to attempt to show whether or not this was possible and to whether or not there was a way to explore different forms of governance in some ways. And so as unlikable as I find these projects, I think they're understandable. I think the contemporary projects that we're looking at now are a little bit different. These are definitely ideological. They're definitely interested in showing how potentially different forms of governance could be possible. But I think the projects that we're looking at now in places like Honduras, these are unfolding in other places as well, parts of the Mediterranean, over in parts of the Balkans. These are projects where I think there's a much more Nietzschean component to them. These are individuals who think they can bend reality to their will. I think they have nothing but disdain for most people in the world. They have an enormous egocentricity. And I think a lot of what they're up to is simultaneously a kind of exit project, sort of leaving the kind of nation state as we know it behind, but in fact, at the same time, privatizing it, seizing it as a new source of revenue, as a new source of investment, as a new way to kind of see their relationship to the state. So it's as much, you know, I came to this conclusion as I was finishing the book, the degree to which so much of this is essentially a kind of form of state capture in many respects.